Welcome to today's Massachusetts Hospital Association conference call, entitled M-Link Session 7, Successful Processes for Detection Sepsis and Initiating Protocols. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. Multiple question and answer sessions will be performed during the presentation, and instructions for asking questions will be given at those times. Thank you for your attention. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Pat Noga from MHA.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Pat Noga, Vice President of Clinical Affairs here at MHA, and thank you very much for joining our program today, which is part of our M-Link Sepsis Learning Series. As you may know, M-Link, our mortality learning and network, was developed over the past year, and it's a peer-based learning opportunity for colleagues at our hospitals to identify best practices correlated with a reduction in mortality, adopt system supports used in high-reliability organizations, and to implement protocols to identify and treat high-risk patients. We've had a number of offerings. We first kicked off in the spring and summer, focusing on structures and processes, and now we're focusing on outcome drivers related to sepsis, and then we'll continue with further programming in the winter of next year. So our sepsis series, as you can see, this is actually the third offering focused on outcomes. And we wanted to post this for you to really let you know that our prior programs are posted on our M-Link, our Patient Care Link website under our M-Link series. You can access them at any time, and all of our future ones will be as well. So for today's program, we have four speakers that I think you will find very informative. And I will be introducing them one by one as we enter from session to session. So our first speaker is Dr. Nathan Shapiro, Vice Chairman of Research, Department of Emergency Medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And he will be speaking on reducing sepsis mortality. Dr. Shapiro?
Hi, thank you very much. So if we just go to the next slide, just in the way of introduction, if there's a 70-year-old female crushing chest pain coming into the emergency department and this EKG comes across, right away that'll really invoke a lot of time urgency, a sense of a rapid chase that needs to occur because we're thinking about an acute MI, calling a cath team, and time is myocardium. If you look at the next slide, a 50-year-old female rollover MVC at a trauma center. There's trauma alerts. A lot of people come down and enter the room, and we're thinking about the golden hour of trauma and, again, mobilizing resources in a time-dependent fashion. Now, the next slide, if we take a 70-year-old female cough, fever, tachycardic, blood pressure 88 over 50, perhaps there's not as much of a time urgency. And at least, especially 5 or 10 years ago, there wasn't as much of a time urgency. And maybe it was antibiotics, some IV fluid, some prayer, and hope for the best. Now, putting it all together in broad strokes, if we think about it, if you take this 70-year-old female with chest pain, ST elevation, MI, mortality is give or take 10%. Rollover MVC, hemodynamically stable, ballpark, let's say 5%. But for the final patient in severe sepsis and or septic shock, the mortality rate's really between 15 and 30%. And so the argument that I think can be made is that there's a real mismatch in resources in that, or we've done a really good job with in the cardiac world with the time is myocardium concept. We've done a really good job in the trauma world with the golden hour of trauma. And now I would propose that if we can think of sepsis in a more time-urgent fashion, we have the opportunity to really curtail downstream morbidity and mortality. So thinking about sepsis, it's classically been presented as a progression of disease, going from SIRS, sepsis, and inflammatory response to severe sepsis defined as one or more organ failures to septic shock. Now we're starting to get cardiovascular collapse, multisystem organ dysfunction, and death. And the real challenge, I think, is that if we can identify patients up in the top of the cascade and treat them early, we can prevent progression before it gets to a point where we can't turn it back. So this slide just takes the concept of the sepsis syndromes and organ dysfunction. And actually, even though there's a lot of attention paid towards the SIRS or sepsis syndromes, really without organ dysfunction, in the emergency department population, mortality rate was not much higher than those without SIRS. But when we get to severe sepsis, so sepsis plus an organ dysfunction, mortality rate, this is in the emergency department, the presence of organ dysfunction in the emergency department for mortality rate in the hospital is 9%, and then 29% mortality if you have septic shock in the emergency department. So clearly the focus on organ dysfunction and shock patients is one where we need to provide additional resources. If we go to the next slide, this just really highlights the importance of organ dysfunction. And what we did was simply created some organ dysfunction definitions in the emergency department. And it had to do with, unfortunately, we don't have a slide for that, renal dysfunction, cardiac dysfunction, metabolic dysfunction, hematologic dysfunction. If you looked at the different possible organ failures and you counted them up, for each organ failure that you had almost a doubling of mortality. So let's say 1% to 6%, then to 13%, 26%, and 53%. So really paying attention to the presence of organ dysfunction is one way to really identify patients at risk who need additional therapies. So just talking about therapies, there was a slide that came out in 1999 that said over 13,000 patients, and this was really a state-of-the-art review from 12 years ago, and it said over 13,000 patients have been enrolled in 23 multi-center placebo-controlled trials. Results have been generally disappointing with some spectacular failures. And really the notion at this point was we don't have a ton to offer to sepsis patients. However, as we see on the next slide, in the early 2000s, there's a number of therapies that hold promise. There's activated protein C, which is a sepsis-specific therapy, early goal-directed therapy, which we'll talk about a little bit more, steroids and adrenal suppression, intensive insulin therapy, and early and appropriate antibiotics. And while steroids and intensive insulin therapy, as well as activated protein C, need to really work out their final formulas and indications, I think it's fair to say that all of these therapies, including goal-directed therapy with a focus on early and aggressive resuscitation and getting antibiotics to patients early, all of these therapies hold promise. And I think it's our responsibility as a medical community to figure out a way to systematically deliver these therapies to the patients who need them. So if we go to the next slide, this is just a highlight of the goal-directed therapy study. And essentially this was early protocolized resuscitation strategy to target physiologic endpoints. And really what it does at the end of the day is facilitate an early and aggressive resuscitation. And when that occurred, in this study in the New England Journal, mortality rate went from 46.5% to 30.5%, so a 16% reduction in absolute mortality. If you see on the next slide, this is the snapshot of the goal-directed therapy protocol. It involves putting in a central line, monitoring CVP and giving fluid boluses, monitoring mean arterial pressure and giving vasoactive agents, and then measuring an SCVO2, which is really the balance of oxygen supply and demand, and treating that with a transfusion or inotropes. And really the goal here is to give a good, aggressive, physiologically-based resuscitation and to measure how you're doing along the way. Now, it takes a coordination of resources. It involves placing a central line as well as CVP monitoring and SCVO2 monitoring. However, the idea is that these are patients who need advanced therapies. They need ICU-level care, and waiting till they get to the ICU is often waiting too late. So the idea has been to bring those resources and roll back the clock and start those therapies in the emergency department. If we go to the next slide. That's sort of a whirlwind review of sepsis, some of the diagnostics and therapies that are out there. And now I'm going to talk about the specific experience we had at our hospital. So back in about, this was actually about 2003, we saw all these therapies available, and we wanted to figure out a way to systematically deliver them to our hospital patients. We created what we call the multiple urgent sepsis therapies, or MUST protocol, and the notion was that we felt that we, quote-unquote, must bring those therapies to the bedside. We've written about the rationale for which therapies we selected, as well as how we did it and our outcomes, and these are the two references for those two writings. If we go to the next therapy, so I'm going to talk about this, we kind of have called it the six-step program we went through. So admission, collaboration, organization, education, implementation, and then evaluation. And so with every program, if we go to the next slide, the first step is admit you have a problem, or give my attempt at humor here. So the idea was you have to recognize that there's a potential for improvement. You have to say that what we're doing is good, but we can do better. The next step that I think was absolutely critical was forming a leadership team, or champions, as it's been labeled. So what we did was we got physicians and nurses together from emergency medicine, the medical intensive care, the surgical intensive care. Subsequently, we've also had additional members from pharmacy join and really think about how we're going to roll this program out from all sides. And by having really six different, or six plus everyone else involved, different opinions coming at it from six different major angles, this really allowed us to make considerations for how different things were going to be handled. And so this leadership team, what we did was we met in a series of regular meetings to talk about what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and how we were going to get there. So if we go to the next slide. Then organization. We spent a fair amount of time organizing what we were going to do before we rolled it out. We actually created a protocol handbook, and the handbook was kind of a blueprint for this, a quick guide, which was a bedside sheet. And then we have posters that we paste up around the emergency department that are also a little bit of this mini playbook. And we had a nursing flow sheet that we adopted our trauma flow sheet to be a sepsis flow sheet, and that's allowed us to really facilitate the protocol at the bedside. Go to the next slide. So this is just the idea of this is our sepsis flow sheet, and we have the algorithm here in captured, as well as we have a different time point. So if you look on protocol checklist, it's protocol initiated and a timestamp and sepsis team activated. And while we don't actually have a sepsis team, the idea is that we our team is the emergency department, and then we also put a page out to let the ICU know that the patients are coming, and then antibiotics given. And so one piece of our protocol, while everything is important and all the hemodynamics are important, we didn't want to forget about our antibiotics. And so the idea is that we use this protocol to help drive it, or this flow sheet to help drive the protocol. If we go to the next sheet, you'll see this is the other page of the protocol, and there's standing orders for labs and then also standing orders for antibiotics. And so this way we can get some of the empiric therapy started. If we go to the next slide, then came the question of how to identify patients. And for this particular, for the protocol of the septic shock protocol, we decided to adapt criteria from the initial RIVER study, which was essentially suspect infection, two or more SIRS criteria, and then evidence of hypoperfusion based on either hypotension after a fluid challenge, so blood pressure less than 90 after fluid challenge, or elevated lactate greater than 4. However, there's the old adage, if you don't check a temperature, you'll never find a fever. So we kind of thought if you don't check a blood, if you don't check a lactate, you won't find it. And so we kind of put out a guideline that said, if you suspect infection, please check a lactate. But to operationalize it, we came up with the idea that we were already getting blood cultures on a lot of patients. And I'm not going to address the question of when is a blood culture indicated. But we said, you know, we're getting a ton of blood cultures on patients, so why not just to make it easy, tell everyone if you're getting a blood culture, you should be sending a lactate as well. And that was a great way to sort of, while it wasn't perfect, a great way to capture the target population with the intent that we were after. If you go to the next slide, please. So then the question is, what's the evidence behind a lactate being a useful screen? And this is data that we looked at. It was 1,300 patients. And if in blue, you see the overall mortality. If your lactate was 0 to 2.4, mortality was 5%, 4.9%. 2.5 to 3.9, 9%, and then overall 28%. And finally, is the patient going to be dead within 3 days? 1.5% if it was 0 to 2.4, 4.5% for 2.5 to 3.9, and 22%. So one out of every five patients is dead within 3 days if their lactate's above 4 in the emergency department. And that's really, this has been some of the data that's driven the idea of lactate screening to risk stratify patients. So if we go to the next slide, the question also comes up. The question looks like the numbers aren't coming up, but this slide in the top yellow is the question is, will we identify patients through their blood pressure if we don't check a lactate? And the top left is those patients who have a low blood pressure and normal lactate. So we would see them because their blood pressure is low. The bottom is those who have both a low blood pressure and a high lactate. And then the top right one on the blue, it's about a third of the patients have high lactate, normal blood pressure. So the idea is that their blood pressure would be normal and we're picking them up by their lactate. You go to the next slide. This just sort of describes the flow. We identify a patient, activate our sepsis team, which again is just our emergency department team. We give early antibiotics, oxygen support while we're putting in central venous access. And then we go to the next slide. We follow the protocol. We've identified norepinephrine as our preferred pressor. And then if you go to the next slide, the patient transitions up to the ICU, and we consider other potential therapies. And so that's sort of the flow of our sepsis protocol. The next step is education, and we spend a lot of time with nursing education going through. We actually, in the initial rollout, did a 3-hour lecture series where we did basic sepsis education, the theory behind goal-directed therapy and how to use the catheter, and then finally physician education we did through a combination of Grand Rounds, handbook, online tutorial. If you go to the next slide. So by the time it came to implement it, we had already done most of the groundwork. We had to adopt the sepsis team mentality of sort of addressing these patients urgently, placing the line. We had a pager available to answer questions, and this really became a nursing-driven protocol where the nurse had the autonomy to essentially follow the protocol within the guidelines. And the last phase is evaluation, and we constantly go back and take a look at it, how we're doing, quality measures, and just the idea that sort of someone's watching is really, really keeps the protocol online. And if we go to the next slide. So this just gives you, this is the results of, we did a before and after study back in 2003 to 2004, and what we saw was that the patients were about the same severity, but the patients in the treatment group, compared to a historical control group, had more fluids, more vasopressors, more red cell transfusion, they got more dobutamine, and we reduced the time to antibiotics. We go to the next slide. Now, and we'll skip one more slide, actually. What we saw was that in the treatment group, our mortality rate was 20.3%, and in the control group, our mortality rate was 9%. So while we didn't have a statistically significant benefit because we would have needed about 900 patients, we did see that we were able to facilitate a more aggressive resuscitation and that there was a mortality benefit in the treatment group. And there's several studies, both in the U.S., Australia, and England, so three studies that are trying to work out the mortality benefit on a larger scale. So if we go to the next slide. So just in conclusion, I'll leave with this, which is in the busy emergency department, your patient comes in with ST elevation MI, you can activate your cath lab or give thrombolytics or transfer them to cath lab. Patient number two, the hemodynamically stable trauma patient, activate your trauma system. And finally, patient number three, think about how to activate a sepsis protocol. And that's where I can conclude and I suppose answer any questions.
Courtney, can you open it up for questions, please?
Thank you. To ask a question, press 0 followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone. Questions will be answered in the order they are received. Again, to ask a question, press 0 followed by 1 now. And our first question comes from Sandra Levin. Please go ahead.
I was wondering if you take out the patients from your studies if their blood cultures are negative eventually, or do you leave them in?
We leave them in, and the rationale is that probably if you take patients in sort of proven septic shock, in other words, pneumonia-proven septic shock, you'll still only get a blood culture yield of about, say, 40 to 60%. So we don't go back and look by blood cultures.
Thank you. Again, to ask a question, press 0 followed by 1 now.
Dr. Shapiro, this is Pat Noga. We had an email, a question emailed to us from, actually it was from Dr. Mark Greenwald at Signature Healthcare Brockton. And the question, I'm going to read it to you right from my email. Were you able to find any references for the claim of mortality based on 1-hour increments to antibiotic use?
So there's a study, there's three recent studies that have addressed it. One is by a guy named Anand Kumar, and he showed that if in patients with septic shock, there's an incremental mortality benefit. There's another study by Dave Gajewski where they showed there's a threshold for benefit. And then there's actually another study that the first author is Mike Basarczyk. And that's a study I was affiliated with, and what we showed was that when you had goal-directed therapy, in general, as long as they got antibiotics in the early period, there was no mortality benefit. But if they were in septic shock, a delay in antibiotics led to mortality benefit. But in that study, almost all patients got antibiotics within the first 4 hours. So, you know, we still haven't worked out the exact mortality benefit or risk based on a delay of antibiotics, but certainly earlier is better, if that answers the question.
Thank you.
And I'm showing that we have no further audio questions at this time.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro.
Great.
Now we will move to our second presentation by Christine Berault and Janet Liddell from Saints Medical Center, and they will be focused on, again, reducing sepsis mortality. Christina and Janet?
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting us to speak about reducing sepsis mortality at Saints Medical Center. My name is Janet Liddell, and my co-presenter is Christina Berault. Next slide, please. Briefly, Saints Medical Center is a small community hospital in Lowell, Massachusetts. We provide primary and acute care services to our residents in 25 towns. We have 5 inpatient units, med-surg, an ICU, and an intermediate care unit. Next slide, please. In 2009, we began to focus on mortality. A few of us attended the IHI National Forum in December of that year, and I had the opportunity to attend a session by Helen Lau from Kaiser Permanente. Her session focused on studying deaths to understand where improvements could be made in their mortality rate. I've included her citation. She recently published an article, and that reference is there on this slide for you. Slide, please. So from that presentation, I brought back 2 things, a framework for a comprehensive mortality review process and a better understanding of some of the underlying factors that affect mortality rates. So that winter, we revitalized our mortality review committee. We invited 4 physicians, 2 nurses, and 1 analyst to our team. At that point, I began conducting 100% mortality case review using the IHI 2x2 matrix and concepts from the global trigger tool. Next slide, please. In my review, I began to see, for those patients coded with severe sepsis and septic shock, that they were presenting to the emergency room with a pattern of signs and symptoms. Their chief complaints were often weakness, lethargy. Their significant others might be reporting mental status changes recently, shortness of breath, and their vital signs showed hypotension, tachycardia, high respiratory rate, low oxygen saturation, and their labs came back with elevated white blood cell and band levels. Next slide, please. I conducted a literature search on the identification and treatment of sepsis, and I came away with these two works cited on this slide as the best evidence-based standards of practice that I could find to share with our staff. And as Dr. Shapiro referenced earlier, the article in the New England Journal of Medicine from 2001 is about early goal-directed therapy. And the second article is the 2008 Surviving Sepsis Campaign and the International Guidelines for the Management of Severe Sepsis and Septic Shock. In addition, Christina and I attended the premier conference in Baltimore of that summer, and we attended mortality and sepsis best practice sessions. Christina?
At the same time, we were monitoring our mortality data. We were looking at both our raw mortality rate, simply our deaths over our discharges over the years, and also really starting to gain an understanding for our mortality index, which was our, for those of you unfamiliar, our rate over our expected rate, which is a risk-adjusted rate derived just from our care science methodology. It takes factors of all the patients, like their comorbidities, their age, smoking history. So when you put your raw, your mortality rate over the expected rate and you translate that fraction into a number, you can take that number to see really where you're sitting. So if you're over a 1 with that number, it kind of lets you know that you're doing a little worse than expected, and when you're under 1, that you're doing worse than expected. Better than expected, excuse me. So from that index, we really started diving into our data and looking at our opportunities by DRG. And sepsis, quarter after quarter, was at the top of that list. So we started to dive even further to see really where we should head with our improvements, and we saw dehydration as secondary diagnosis. And so at this point, everything was really lining up for us. Janet's case reviews, the literature searches, the data, it was all pointing in the same direction. So we really felt that we knew where we needed to go.
So we brought back our findings from all of these sources to our mortality review committee, and we recommended that our physicians, along with nurses and analysts, focus on sepsis. So our physicians began reviewing cases for all severe sepsis and septic shock. In discussions on those cases, it always came up that maybe the record wasn't coded correctly. So I met with coding to try to understand the indicators and the documentation that they need to see in the medical record in order to code it as severe sepsis or septic shock. I was enlightened by that discussion, and I brought those findings back to the committee, and everyone found a lot of value in knowing what actually contributes to severe sepsis and septic shock. At that point, we began to collect data around the four elements of the IHI sepsis resuscitation bundle, those being, were blood cultures drawn before antibiotics, and this is in the ED, or when sepsis is identified, when were IV fluids initiated and at what rate, were antibiotics given within 1 hour of arrival, and were lactic acids being measured? Next slide, please. Our findings revealed a significant lack of fluid resuscitation in the emergency room. There was inconsistent, if any, lactic acid measurements, and in our discussions, it became apparent that there was a strong reluctance to implement rapid fluid resuscitation in our emergency room because reportedly we had a high hemodialysis and congestive heart failure population. However, on a positive note, patients were receiving antibiotics within 1 hour of arrival. They were getting their blood cultures drawn before antibiotics were given. and we had the full support of the physicians on our mortality committee to make improvements, and in particular, a hospital physician that became our champion to drive this improvement forward.
So at this point, we had a lot of information, and we knew a lot of improvements that could be made with sepsis directly. So we revitalized the hospital sepsis committee, and we let it out of the quality department. It's a great team. It's very dedicated. It's very supportive, a lot of physicians and nurses from the ED. Extremely interdisciplinary, pharmacy, lab, infection control, and also very timely webinar series that we participated in through our alliance with the premier national place. So they did webinars. We got to hear faculty speakers about evidence-based practices. We got to share tools and hear other experiences from other hospitals going through the same things that we were going through. So that was great for us to learn from. It was very timely. Next slide. With the sepsis committee, we also shared with them what we were learning on the mortality committee and also shared the articles that Janet was referencing so that they could really understand that this wasn't just a Saints issue, this was a national issue, and you know we really were armed with a lot of information to help everyone succeed. So on the sepsis committee, we started to develop our algorithm. You can go to the next slide, please. So we looked at what we were already doing for our protocol, and we utilized examples that we had learned from our webinars, and we started looking at what we needed to do. We knew we needed to improve the identification of sepsis and triage and begin that rapid fluid resuscitation as soon as necessary, and we also had a goal of having nurse-initiated fluid resuscitation, which was a process change for us. So we did need a MedExec approval, and once we had our algorithm designed, we brought it to MedExec and got their approval in December, and our new algorithm went live in January, which is on the next slide. And it may be a little hard to see here for you, but everyone here has really embraced it. We love it for many reasons. We think that it's pretty easy to look at. It's intuitive clinically. That first box is a checklist of signs that are universally known as indicators for sepsis. And if the patient has those, it leads you right down to initiating that rapid fluid resuscitation, ordering a sepsis lab order set, and alerting the physician. So it really gets you down to getting that patient treated as soon as possible, that early goal-directed therapy. So it's working really well. Next slide, please. This is just a sample of our sepsis mortality based on patients identified in the ED. The purple line is the rate of death for patients that did receive the protocol in the emergency department, and the maroon line is the rate of death for patients that did not receive the protocol. So you can see that we do have a distinct difference with that. Next slide, I guess. So, ongoing performance improvement monitoring. We still continue to collect data on our sepsis mortality every month and the bundle compliance review in the emergency department. We also, our sepsis committee still does case reviews, and we look at data from all different ways to see where we need to improve. And we're also in the process of implementing a version of our algorithm for the inpatient setting and utilizing our rapid response team when necessary to help to get that rapid response team, the rapid fluids and everything that the patient needs. So thank you very much again. And the last slide is just our contact information. So thank you.
Moderator, can you ask if there are any questions, please?
Sure. If you would like to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, questions will be answered in the order they are received. To ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 now. And I'm showing that we have no questions at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, Christina and Janet. I really enjoyed seeing how you actually mobilized some change within your institution and worked on buy-in, so congratulations to you. Next, Erin Donovan from Lowell General Hospital, and she will be speaking to us about the early recognition of sepsis in her institution. I'm sorry, it's actually Erin Donovan and Janice Breton.
Right. Good afternoon, everyone. And I am here with Janice Breton, who is in nursing informatics in our department here. Can we go on the first slide, please? So I just wanted to kind of start with a little bit of a overview of our mortality program. For many years, we've been looking at all deaths that occur within the hospital, and that's primarily done through a quality nurse doing an initial screen of all of the cases. And they have some exemption criteria that they look at for deaths. For instance, if a patient is care or comfort only or an end-stage disease. But otherwise, those cases would go up for a next level of review at a physician level. And so we have in place a peer review process where we have a council that meets monthly that's made up of physicians from across many specialties in the hospital, and they examine all the mortalities and all the complications that occur. I did in 2007 to become a participant in the American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, and we signed up for general and vascular surgeries. This is a great program. I'm sure many of you are participating in it because it gives you some data on your post-op occurrences. So you get to see mortalities and complications and be able to compare them with benchmark data, with national data. What's nice also is that the data is risk-adjusted, which really gives you that apples-to-apples comparison. So can we go to the next slide? So we did see in our peer review council process that we happened to notice a number of cases, post-op cases, where patients were becoming septic and we had transfers down to the ICU that were unplanned. We were seeing kind of anecdotally more mortalities occurring. We already had a rapid response team in place, so it wasn't a question of, you know, not having the resources available to treat that. But what we decided was that we really needed to focus on some of the early recognition signs of sepsis. So we put together a team primarily consisting of nursing, but with physician input, infection control, and a big portion of that being nursing informatics. And it was facilitated by a nurse in the quality department with the goal to hopefully prevent some of these unplanned transfers and lower the number of cases that we were seeing through peer review. One of the things that we wanted to be sure to do was try and attempt to keep the idea of sepsis in front of the direct care provider. We're all for education and we like education, but education does have some limitations. There's turnover, so new staff coming in that haven't had the education. There's a lot coming at nurses with education in terms of, you know, joint commission preparation. There's all kinds of new things coming at them, and so we wanted to somehow separate this as being just one other thing that we were trying to get across to them. So we wanted to find a constant state of awareness. At the same time, we had a relatively new electronic medical record. We went live with nursing documentation in our EMR in 2007. And over those 2 years, we found this to be a very powerful tool for us in terms of forcing documentation and providing alerts to nurses, and it's been very successful for us in driving quality of care. So we we thought there might be some way that we could use it again to help us improve our goals here. One of the drawbacks with an EMR is that nurses can tend to become very task-focused and tend not to have a lot of time for critical thinking. So we wanted to also ensure that critical thinking remained intact when they were looking at their patients. Can we go to the next slide? So I'm going to turn the presentation over to Janice for a few minutes, and she's going to walk you through some of what we've put together in the medical record.
Good morning. Lowell General Hospital uses the Cerner Millennium application, which includes nursing documentation, meds administration, and order entry. As of April of this year, 2011, we also included physician order entry. Our screenshots will display prints of what we refer to as power forms, which are used for nursing documentation. We're also going to include some orders, nursing tasks, as they appear in our electronic medical record. Just a brief background on how the power forms were developed. A septic task force was established. The team included physicians, critical care nurses, clinical nurse specialists, pharmacists, quality, and risk management. Being a magnet hospital and working under our shared governance model of forwarded to our Nursing Informatics Council. Our structure at Lowell General supports a council devoted to informatics. This is an interdisciplinary council consisting of not only nursing representation, but from ancillary departments such as PT and OT, pharmacists, respiratory therapy, dietary quality, infection control, clinical nurse specialist, and analysts from our information services department. They were instrumental in shaping the look of these assessment tools and assessing the impact on nursing workflow. Found in three of our assessment tools, the adult admission history, pre-op assessment, and our adult ongoing daily assessment, which is done Q-shift on each patient. Done on all of our med-surg units. In our critical care areas, we utilize an interactive flow sheet and not power forms. And because of the nature of a critical care nurse and their assessment skills, the task force wanted to devote its attention to the enhancing the critical thinking skills of our med-surg nurses with prevention. If you look at the screen that's up, the infection screening power form includes three sections: catheter-acquired UTI screening, suspected infections, and MRSA and VRE. The MRSA and VRE screening is only done on our initial adult historical assessment. The catheter-acquired UTI screening and sepsis screening is done on a Q-shift basis. Note in the middle the question for sepsis
Moderator, she's blanking out.
And I'm sorry, we do have the presenter's line still connected.
Janet?
We are connected.
We are connected.
You keep periodically, like, blanking out, pausing. I don't know why.
I can hear that fuzziness, too, so I'm not sure what it is.
Janice, if you could just go back to where you were referring to the middle of that screen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. In the question in the middle of the screen, we were just pointing out that we don't ask if the patient has sepsis. We're asking, does the patient have an infection, promoting the start of critical thinking skills. Next slide, please. When a nurse answers yes to the does the patient have a known or suspected infection, a conditional field will open up, addressing the criteria to assess for indications of SIRS. The yellow highlighted areas reflect the mandatory fields that must be addressed. Next slide. On this slide, we built in what is called a SMART template in the lower left corner. We wanted to provide for the nurse all the values that have been documented throughout the electronic medical record into one useful area. We felt that looking throughout a chart for specific values did not provide the nurse a clear picture of their patient. Here a nurse is able to see the CS criteria, and using the SMART template, the last charted value of each result is there for them, thus providing them the tools to easily assess their patients. Next slide. When the assessment is done and a CS criteria score is established, we developed a workflow for follow-up. There is a rule built behind the scenes that is activated when a patient's CS score is documented as 2 or greater. This rule will activate an order to notify the physician of the patient's status. Note the red lettering in the middle of the power form. This is a hint to the nurse to remember that when they do speak to the physician to include in your discussion the patient's vital signs, lab values, urinary output, and lung sounds. Next slide. The rule activates the following: an order, a task, and a physician notification. The name of the order is Notify MD Sepsis, with the instructions alerting the nurse that the patient has met CS criteria. The term system that you can see in the picture of the order, it's just a notification to anyone who's viewing our electronic medical record that that order was placed by a rule in the back end and it wasn't physician generated. MD Sepsis order activated this task, reminding the nurse to call a physician. When she does reach the physician, she will click on the task and it will automatically open up this next power form called Physician Communication Log. She will use this to document her conversation with the physician. We use this power form for any communication with our physicians that we want documented within the record. The sepsis task force felt that we needed to stay with our current practice of documenting physician communications, but wanted to be able to easily trend infection documentation, so we renamed this form Infection Screening MD Notify, which can be seen in the left upper corner of the screenshot. In this section, Reason the Physician Notified, sepsis criteria is an easy checkoff box. Comment section is where any recommendations or treatments ordered by the physician can be documented. When the power form is completed and signed by the nurse, the task will fall for task list and notify MD order will be completed.
Janet?
Can we go to the next slide?
Yes. Sorry, we heard a pause again.
So, after we put this together, it was time to do the rollout. And every year we usually have an educational program for nursing staff. So, this was 2009 when we were doing this work. So, we had what we call a summer camp for nurses where we ask them to come for mandatory education. And this is where we would present some of the important things that we thought were going on this year that we wanted to highlight. And so we certainly included our sepsis work in this and put together a nice classroom setting because we felt it lended a lot of importance to the subject. We didn't want to go into one of these 10 to 15 minute presentations at a staff meeting. We really wanted them to be good saturation of the information for the nurses. Can we go to the next slide? So when we looked at the education that we were providing during the summer camp session, we wanted to definitely make the case for sepsis. And we included a lot of the national statistics that have been discussed and are out there.
We talked about numbers that we were seeing in LGH and kind of delved into some of the cases that we've had here in the past that had mortalities associated with them. We also spent some time really going into what sepsis is, the medicine of sepsis, or the biology. We wanted them to understand what was happening in the body when sepsis strikes. And so this presentation was all put together by a clinical nurse specialist.
And I'm sorry, your phone line did cut out a little bit.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. We did take them through the stages of sepsis and spent particular amount of time focusing on the warning signs. So we really wanted to give them a nice, strong foundation before then going into our plan of attack and the Elmer enhancements. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to share with you, this is something that MHA put out a little while ago, and this is our 2009 sepsis data, and you can see that it shows a little general compared to the statewide experience with sepsis. And so at a mortality rate of 32-33%, we're falling right in that window for sepsis. So I'll actually be interested in seeing subsequent reports come out on this. Can we go to the next slide, please? So looking at outcomes, again, our focus was primarily post-op patients. And as I said, this is NISQIP data, so we started it in 2007. We get semi-annual reports from NISQIP that are risk-adjusted. And is sepsis over time and septic shock over time. And you can see in the early years we were higher in sepsis than when we went live in the second half of 2009. We had a nice little drop. And I think it's probably a little more evident in the slide looking at septic shock over time. A nice decline there. Can we go to the next slide? And in terms of our overall inpatient mortality rate, you know, again, we're showing higher levels, 1.8. This is a straight raw mortality rate. It's 1.8 for 2007 and 2008. And then in 2009, that nice decline to 1.4, and we're seeing it a little more this past year, 2010. Next slide. Final thoughts on this whole project. We wanted to make sure this was really going to work, and so the team that we put together was really heavily weighted on nursing. It's just not going to be effective if they don't like the tools, if they're not useful for them, if they're not helping them at all. And so you know, nursing informatics and the frontline nurses were really quite crucial to this process. One of the things that I thought was very successful was really tying the tool to the critical thinking. The tool gives that nurse that decision tree that he or she has to go through in their assessment in determining and recognizing early sepsis. And it's really made them become much more confident in their skills at doing this. After deployment, we did need to reinforce what was taught in the classroom. We did see some questions answered wrong, especially that first question was occasionally answered wrong. And so we did do some one-to-one re-education with staff as necessary. And I think that was also very helpful in solidifying the process for staff. And finally, sharing the outcomes. This really gives nurses an appreciation for how impactful their assessments and actions can be to patient outcomes, and was just powerful for us. So that wraps up our presentation. If anyone has any further questions or would like some of the presentations that we gave, educational presentations, we're happy to share that with you.
Thank you. To ask a question, press 0 followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone. Questions will be answered in the order they are received. Again, to ask a question, press 0 followed by 1 now. Please hold for a moment as our system compiles your responses. And I'm showing that we have no questions at this time, and I would like to turn the call back over to Ms. Noga.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Erin and Janice. I also found very valuable the point that you made about the tools that you've developed and the queuing that you have in place to educate the nurses so that then they integrate it into their practice, hopefully, sort of an automatic piece of their assessment that they do complete on an ongoing basis. So I thought that was really great. Okay, and now we'll be turning to our last speaker, Geraldine McCoyd, who's the Director of Hospital Education and Infection Control at Fairview Hospital. And Jerry is going to speak to working across settings to effectively identify patients with sepsis. Jerry?
Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Well, Fairview took a very different road at looking at sepsis. In Great Barrington, Mass., we are very rural. Fairview is a 25-bed critical access hospital. And within a 3-mile radius of the hospital, we have 3 large long-term care facilities and rehab facilities. And so what we were doing is we were looking at the admissions of patients from long-term care through the emergency room. And there was a very clear indication that these patients were coming in advanced states of sepsis because they weren't being identified early in the sepsis cascade. So what we ended up doing is getting a hold of leadership at the 3 nursing homes. The administrator, the director of nursing, was the initial meeting. The hospital hosted a meeting. We got great participation from the 3 nursing homes. And we started to look at the patients that we share. We're a rural community. And how could we partner with each other to benefit both nurses in long-term care, nurses at the hospital, and above all, the patients that we shared from the community? So when we looked at it, the nursing homes very clearly identified that because of reimbursement issues, they didn't always have the resources that they needed. So we decided to offer a model of collaboration between the hospital and our long-term care partners. And can you have the next slide, please? So what we agreed on was that we wanted to do something that benefited our nurses, that absolutely indicated with our Press Ganey customer satisfaction scores an increase not only in patient satisfaction but in nursing retention in long-term care because their turnover rates were high and they were very willing to share that with us. And we embarked on figuring out a way where we could increase the clinical skills of long-term care nurses so that they would feel more comfortably, be able to critically think, and have the clinical skills to identify sepsis early in the cascade. And we went about doing that by, number one, we offered a preceptorship to any of their nurses. They stayed on the nursing home payroll. They came to the hospital. They did anywhere between 6 to 8 weeks on our med-surg unit. We offered a physical assessment program. We offered one-to-one mentoring. As infection control, I already reviewed all of the cultures from all three of the nursing homes, so I had a very good idea of what was going on. And in June of 2008, we decided to look at sepsis just related to patients coming from the three long-term care facilities. So we looked from, can you go to the next slide, please? We looked at the total number of sepsis patients that were admitted from long-term care were 12. The number was small, so we decided that the number should be much higher, but of that, 50% were so sick that from the emergency department they had to be admitted to ICU. The other 50% went to the med-surg unit. That's when we started our bombardment of education, and the first program that we offered was sepsis education. I went to the three nursing homes. We had great attendance from all three shifts, and at that time, the average length of stay for a patient from long-term care for sepsis was 5.3 days. After we instituted our program, in the next year, we went from June 1st of 2009 through May 10th of 2010. The amount of sepsis patients identified from long-term care were 25. Of these 25, 18, for 72%, were admitted to the med-surg unit, and only 7, 28%, were admitted to ICU. The average length of stay dropped from 5.3 days to 3.7. At the same time, physicians were provided with education around sepsis identification and coding at the time of admission. Fairview had a very active sepsis task force made up of physicians, pharmacy, nursing, lab, quality improvement. In that year, from June of 2009 to May of 2010, absolutely long-term care nurses identified sepsis much earlier in the sepsis cascade. Then I think we decided to bring this forward, too, because sepsis is so ongoing, and because of the nursing turnover in long-term care, when we offered education between June 1st to March, the amount of participation from long-term care had dropped off, and you can see what happened. We only admitted 14 patients. We had a reverse in the numbers. Only 43% or 6 went to the med-surg unit, and 57% of 8 patients went to ICU, and the average length of stay went up to 5.1 again. Fairview does a 100% review of all mortality cases, and probably in those 3 years, 90% of the mortality cases that were not hospice cases, comfort care only, 90% were sepsis patients. So that was one of our issues. So now, after March 31st of this year, we then met with all of the acute care nursing staff. We invited educators, the clinical specialist, along with the quality improvement nurse. We met again with the three nursing homes, and we've brought a fourth on board. And we met this time with administrators, director of nurses, and staff development people. And so we have quite a hefty calendar going forward with our program, of which a lot of it, I think it would be interesting, the other presenters, to look at the amount of sepsis coming into the emergency department as to where did they come from, because we know that in our community, at least 80% of the sepsis patients presenting in the ED are from long-term care. And they are the population that is at high risk for a lot of different reasons. The next slide, please. This is a good visual, and this shows you what happened in the amount of time in June of 2009 to May of 2010, you could see that that was the year we had a lot of education going on. We had long-term care nurses preceptoring at the hospital. They had attended physical assessment. We had offered sepsis education, and I traveled to three facilities. And you can see that our med-surg admissions went way up, our ICU admissions went down, and also in that year, even though we had twice the amount of patients, our mortality rate for sepsis patients dropped by 50%. So, you know, that is where we're continuing to look, is with long-term care. And we hope that as we go along, the numbers are going to absolutely prove out that it is better to look also into the community where these patients are probably going to come from and try to not only prevent sepsis, but if we can't prevent it, catch it much earlier in the sepsis cascade. Thanks.
Thank you. And to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 on your touch-tone phones now. Again, to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1.
You know, one of the things, too, that we did, because it's very hard with resources as limited as they are to release nurses to be coming off-site from the nursing homes to the hospital, all of the education programs that we offered, we supplied DVDs to all of the nursing homes so that if nurses couldn't attend, they at least were able to participate in the education watching the DVDs. And what we're now doing because of staffing issues is we are now preceptoring long-term care nurses on all three shifts. And we're willing to take them whenever they can be released. So I think that was another thing, is that, you know, it teaches you that you may not think as an acute care hospital you have enough resources, but when you look at what your long-term care peers are working with, then it really hits you exactly how many resources you have.
And I am showing that we have no questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Jerry, it's Pat. Just, you know, a point that you did speak to the fact that, you know, your communication between your practice settings or among your practice settings really, you know, really was enhanced with this work. And I'm sure that not only with this work, but with your other initiatives, just getting to know each other more will certainly go a long way, in, you know, in future successes. So, you know, I do applaud you for that.
Oh, thank you. And, of course, a lot of that is because our Vice President of Operations, Doreen Hutchinson, she is very visionary in reaching out to different segments of the community. And this certainly, we share the same patients. So,
right.
Thanks, Pat.
You're welcome. Okay, one last call. Any further questions?
Again, to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1. And we have no further questions.
Okay, then. Well, on behalf of everyone who's been participating, I really, again, wanted to thank all of our presenters. I really learned something from every presentation, and it's just great to have presenters from four of, you know, hospitals across the state, so everyone really can get a sense of the great work that's going on regarding sepsis prevention and initiating protocols for managing sepsis across our hospitals. Before we leave, just wanted to remind you that we will be sending out an eval, just a quick SurveyMonkey eval, to get feedback from you on this session. We also will be posting the slides and the audio from this session on the Patient Care Link website under Preventing Mortality. And we do have two more programs coming up, October 13th, Sepsis Bundles Implementation Strategies, and November 10th, implementing systems and clinical processes for managing sepsis. That is part of our sepsis portion of the MLINC portfolio. So again, thank you for your time, and hope to see you participating in our future events. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All listeners may now disconnect.